really, the idea is that we want to prevent the Pacific Islands from becoming strategic assets for China.
Russia and Chinese don't like each other very much, but by the requirement of strategy, they have to get closer.
Are we on the right track here if the four countries don't even agree on what constitutes an aggression?
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College. This discussion was recorded before President Biden cancelled his visit to Australia and the postponement of the Quad Leaders meeting. We've decided to release the episode because the conversation covers material that is topical and timely, despite the change of plans, including the G7 summit, the invasion of Ukraine, and other current issues facing the Indo-Pacific. We plan to examine the implications of President Biden's cancellation in future episodes. In the meantime, enjoy.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast from the National Security College here at the Australian National University. We're recording on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. I'm Rory Medcalf, the head of the National Security College at ANU, and it's a particular delight today to welcome three distinguished experts, practitioners, colleagues, and indeed longtime friends of the college for what I'd like to call a quad pod. This is a podcast that is primarily about the forthcoming Quad Leaders Summit in Sydney in Australia, which in itself is a pretty historic event coming up on the 24th of May. But it's a centerpiece of a season, an extraordinary season of Indo-Pacific diplomacy. Not only do we have the G7 summit coming up in Japan, in Hiroshima, from the 19th to the 21st of May, we also expect visits to Papua New Guinea by Prime Minister Modi of India and President Biden of the United States, just a day after that, 22nd of May. There's, of course, also the Shangri-La dialogue coming up in Singapore a little bit later as well, where the Australian Prime Minister is the keynote speaker. So it's an extraordinary season of Indo-Pacific diplomacy, comes against the backdrop, of course, of a deepening contest for influence in the Indo-Pacific, very much revolving around the way China has been using its growing power and influence, but also, of course, the tragic and really terrifying context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the continuing war in Ukraine. So much happening on the global stage in this era of complex uncertainty. Let me introduce our three guests and we'll get into the conversation, into the quad pod. And as I said, our three guests not only reflect expertise and experience, but also, of course, between us, between the four of us, we cover the four nations of the Quad. So it's a particular pleasure to welcome back to the college Darshana Barua. Darshana, who has worked with us extensively, particularly on Indian Ocean issues, is director of the Indian Ocean Initiative and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. So welcome to the program, Darshana.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here with all of you.
And joining us from Japan is Professor Nobukatsu Kanohara, who is currently professor of Doshisha University, but is also very well known to us as a key advisor of Prime Minister Abe, the late Prime Minister Abe Shinzo, in capacity as effectively Deputy National Security Advisor to the Prime Minister at a crucial time in developing Japan's free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. So welcome to you as well, Nobu.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And last but absolutely not least, Lisa Curtis. Lisa, welcome back as well to the college. And Lisa, as well as playing a key role in formulation of American Indo-Pacific policy in government, is joining us now in your capacity as director of Indo-Pacific Security Program at CNAS, the Center for New American Security. So, Lisa, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Rory. It's great to be here.
So let's get right into it. And Norbu, I'm going to begin with you because, of course, the G7 summit is coming up first, beginning on the 19th of May. What do you consider to be the objectives of the summit from the point of view of Japanese strategy? And how do you see in particular the summit and the associated meetings, you know, the visits of other Indo-Pacific leaders to Japan, to converge with the objectives of Prime Minister Kishida's Indo-Pacific strategy?
No, thank you very much. I think that's the objective of Prime Minister Kishida. Now, there are several things, but the biggest objective is to enhance the unity of the West and enlarge the international liberal order into the global South. That is the key issue. Japan is now the number three in terms of the economic size, but China became three times bigger than Japan last one decade. Amazing, isn't it? India is now already half of Japan. ASEAN nations in total is now their size is the 75% of Japan. In 10 years' time, ASEAN and India would be bigger than Japan in terms of economic size. And this is reality. 1990, G7 nations occupied 75% of world production. Today, it is less than 50%. So we have to be united. First of all, the Brexit and America first, these things, unity of the West is shattered. But thanks to Mr. Biden and the Western leaders, we get united against the invasion of Russia into Ukraine. We have to keep it, but it's not enough. We have to enlist the support of many other friends in the rising world of the global South. This is the first objective. And Prime Minister is now saying that the international community must be based upon rule of law. We cannot tolerate the invasion. We cannot tolerate the abuse of human rights of ethnic minorities. We cannot allow that the market distorting practice prevail in the free markets. So we have to sustain this order. And the challenges are, of course, one, the biggest challenge is, of course, the war in Ukraine. This is the flamboyance, violation of international law. And who is doing this? This is the permanent member of the Security Council, the legitimate nuclear power states. And Putin is invading Ukraine and threatening Ukraine by saying that he might use nuclear weapons in Belarus. And we have to show our unity. If the West is united, the NATO nation, Japan and Australia, we could help Ukrainians. And our economic size is more than 30 times bigger than Russia. But the number of soldiers is much inferior in Ukraine. So we have to make them the biggest advance. Otherwise, they would collapse. And I don't know, maybe this year, but we can't continue this forever. At some moment, there could be some decisive moment. Then in that moment, we have to help Zelensky to take back as much territory as possible. This is the first thing to do, to maintain our unity vis-a-vis Russia's invasion. This is the first. Second is how to cope with rising China. China, we have still the maneuver, the room of maneuvering for diplomacy. We have the very independent economies, but China these days weaponize this independent economy, the independence of economy, and they sometimes put the pressure for, say, I don't buy bananas from the Philippines, I don't buy pineapples from Taiwan, and shut all the doors for the imports from Lithuania, and shut the door to sell the rare earth to Japan. They do these kind of things. How to cope with it? China is not very big. As far as the West is united, we can push them back. But if the West is not united, unless the United States, all the nations must surrender to China one by one. And we have to have, of course, the Taiwan contingency in mind. The Westerners, Easterners, NATO, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Australia, we have to focus on the Euro-Asian continent as one theater. We have to look at both sides. And they are now approaching each other. Russia and Chinese don't like each other very much. But by the requirement of strategy, they have to get closer. That pushes away India from these totalitarian nations. And India is now moving slowly from Russia to the West. We have to take in India. And this is vital for the future of the cooperation between Global South and the West. And I have to say Pacific Islanders are now the field of competition of big powers. Before it was Taiwan versus China. Now it is the China versus the West. And we have to focus on this on these islands. We are inviting now Komoro. The Komoro is now president of the Pacific Island Forum. And here in this G7, we of course invite Korea and the India and Brazil, and the G7 chairman, G20 chairman, ASEAN chairman. But we have to add the PIF Pacific Islands Forum chairman here, in particular Solomon. They have domestic difficulties divided into two parts: pro-China people, pro-Taiwan people, and China successful in implementing the implanting their influence in the Solomon. That is the strategic island that Japan and the United States fought against each other in the Pacific War. So now this is a new focus, and here this is the responsibility of Quad. We have to make a clear. We have to make our message clear that we are going to incorporate these Pacific Islanders into our Pacific economic entity, and we have to show them the options. China is not the only option. We have options, and we can help you. And these things are the most important agenda, I believe, for Mr. Kishida for coming G7 summit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Norbu. And that's an extraordinary set of challenges for Japanese diplomacy to coordinate such an array of countries on such fundamental issues. And one question we may come back to throughout the conversation goes actually to that global nature of the challenge of averting conflict in the Indo-Pacific, for example, how to ensure that there is essentially a kind of economic deterrence against China taking aggressive action against Taiwan. But let's just pause on that for a moment. You've got some good markers there on engaging the Global South, on the Ukraine conflict, on the Pacific, that we'll come back to in other parts of the conversation. I will now turn our sights to Port Moresby, to Papua New Guinea, because, of course, immediately after the G7 summit, we'll see two really quite historic visits to PNG, essentially at the same time, by the leaders of India and the United States. And look, Dashana, I might go to you first, because I think it's been since at least late last year that there have been reports and rumours that Prime Minister Modi would go to Papua New Guinea. And some cynical observers would kind of wonder why. India is very focused on the Indian Ocean. India is very focused on its own neighbourhood. Why PNG? So can you shed a bit of light on, I think, the purpose and expectations of Mr. Modi's journey to Port Moresby?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much. I think so. The PNG summit, the Pacific Island Summit in PNG, is actually a revival of India's standing annual India Pacific Island Forum, which started, I believe, in 2015. I could be wrong. It may have started in 2016. But there were two specific editions that happened, and it has been on pause since the outbreak of the pandemic, and it hasn't happened since then. And for the last year or so, at least, there has been conversations about bringing it back. It was meant to be an annual, or at least every year and a half, 2 years time period. So it does predate the conversation on the Pacific that we know as it today because of the developments that happened in the region last year. So from my point of view, I think, A, of course, this is a revival of India's outreach to the Pacific, which started sometime in 2015, 2016, and trying to take that conversation forward. India does not have the presence in Pacific theater the way it does in Indian Ocean or even in Southeast Asia, but that was something that has long been talked about and discussed because of course, the diaspora, but also the opportunities in terms of investments and partnerships and training and, you know, both on traditional and non-traditional security issues. Indian naval ships are not as present in the Pacific, in the South Pacific, but I don't think so. That is the main motive or the goal either. It's of course, they have been there for ad hoc exercises, again, passing exercises and port calls. But with India's own outreach towards Indian Ocean, India's own sort of engagement with island nations, and last Quad Summit, the joint statement did talk about what working together, coordinating together to work better with the Pacific Island nations, as well as Southeast Asia and countries in the Indian Ocean region. So I would imagine that all of that perhaps converged at some point. And I think it's actually an excellent idea that if you're going to be in the region and if you have voiced your interest and concerns, or if you've voiced your, you know, deep interest in engaging with the region, that you don't come away without actually engaging with the island nations there. So I would say it's a great opportunity, and it's pretty much in line with diplomatic protocols where heads of government go to a particular region, and then even beyond the primary bilateral meeting, you hold and talk with other countries and your counterparts who are important to you. So I would see that as an opportunity in reviving the Indo-Pacific island conversation, and at a time where I think the Pacific Island nations are welcoming and open to more collaborations and partnerships outside of traditional partners.
Look, thanks. And I think looking at the practicality of it all, you know, there are clearly things that India can bring to Pacific Island partners as a partner, as its own, I guess, its own kind of leader of the developing world, the global south, and as a country that has had to deal with its own development challenges. I even look at issues like healthcare, for example, in Papua New Guinea, and imagine that there are lessons that can be learned from the Indian experience. So, do you have a sense of what are the practical initiatives that you imagine an Indian government might bring to do more with the Pacific?
The meeting is at PNG, but it's with the wider Pacific
Island. 14 other leaders, I think.
Yes.
Or thereabouts.
I would imagine, like you said, healthcare. But the other aspect that I see that perhaps could be on discussion point would be the IT and the tech part of it, whether it's on the cyber, whether it's on the tech side of it, the digital infrastructure connectivity, because within Carnegie, we run the Islands Dialogue in New York each year. And at least in those conversations, it's come up quite often from the region that, you know, we need to talk and think more about digital infrastructure, the technology aspect of it, but also cyber education. You know, if you're going to give make internet available to people in remote parts of the islands, which I think what India has done really well in making internet available in remote parts of India, so it's something that can be extended. But you also need to sensitize online content for children, for sort of young adults, and all of that. So it's really the fundamentals and the basics, as well as not just providing the infrastructure, but also the training and the management and helping navigate the web and the internet. I think all of that, and I think that is something India can provide. Of course, there are other aspects on health, and I think I would see elements of climate, definitely. I would see elements of blue economy. These would all be conversations, hospitals that I would imagine. But I do hope that I will see some conversation on IT and tech part and the digital side of it, because I think that's a really ripe area for collaboration and cooperation. That's something India can successfully provide to the region.
And kind of a reminder that China is not the only option that developing countries can turn to. Before I go to Lisa and the question of American strategy here, one slightly thorny question, Darshana. There's been some reporting in the Indian media that there was unhappiness in some quarters of the Indian system, or frustration that Mr. Modi's visit might be overshadowed by President Biden's visit, even though I guess it was obviously opportune for the two leaders to be there around the same time on the eve of the Quad. What's your assessment?
I'm not privy to any of those conversations, but then I think from where I sit, I think it was more perhaps a coordination misstep or an opportunity, because like I said, for India, this had been on the cards for a while to revive the Pacific Island Forum engagement. And U.S. is, of course, recommitted in a very big way to the Pacific with the White House summit last year. So it only made sense that if President Biden was going to be in the region, that you also make that outreach, because I would imagine if he were in the region and did not have an engagement, it would immediately draw criticism that, okay, you know, Washington laid out all of these, but then you were in the region and you didn't engage. And I would imagine similar would have happened with India. So perhaps it's more about the coordination, but perhaps it's also about that leaders like President Biden and Prime Minister Modi don't go to the region as often. So, you know, maybe the region is not used to that kind of attention in terms of having such high level diplomatic attention and visits to the area. So I would chalk it up as perhaps a coordination misstep, not with any ill intention or sort of, you know, trying to upstage one another. It also goes to talk about more maybe coordination between countries, but I imagine that would too be difficult because don't think it's the norm for countries to share the travel plans of prime ministers and presidents unless there's a direct conversation between the two countries to offer that information. So maybe that is somewhere a misstep. And because you're not used to seeing these kind of presence in the Pacific, it probably didn't cross. I would call it a bureaucratic probably misstep than anything else. I think both are very...
I guess the question for me is more, you know, is there going to be any kind of genuine damage to relationships? As far as I can tell, there isn't.
I don't think so. I think it would probably be a conversation. I don't see this becoming having a negative impact. Delhi and Washington has better communication today than it ever did before.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty confident that anything that comes out of it will be navigated diplomatically. And I think for probably the concern is more in terms of the region, if the region has the capacity to manage two summits at this level. And I think that both Washington and Delhi should be conscious of that and not put it on the region to be able to and expect them to, I think, manage the protocols of it when the capacity is much higher on both Washington and Delhi side. And I would say that both Delhi and Washington should be more careful and cautious about how they present themselves in the region rather than the other way around.
I guess also to flip it around, there is a pretty powerful message having the leaders of these two great global democracies in PNG at the same time. And of course, PNG itself is a complicated but vibrant democracy. So you know, I can see a real positive if this is presented the right way.
We'll be right back.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Lisa, let's turn to you if we may. And you know, as I said at the beginning, you've been in and around American Indo-Pacific strategy really for some time, and of course, I think your role with NSC and the Trump administration, I think, was pretty crucial to getting the foundations of an Indo-Pacific strategy for the United States. I think there's been considerable continuity, actually, in the way that that's developed, and from where I sit, it looks like it's becoming a more comprehensive strategy. But I wonder what you think, including about the importance of this visit by President Biden to PNG, where PNG and the Pacific sit in the Indo-Pacific vision of the administration. What do you expect?
Well, thank you. And I think you're right, Rory. I think there has been more continuity than change when it comes to how the U.S. views the Indo-Pacific and the strategies that both came out of the Trump administration. That was the Indo-Pacific Strategic Framework, which of course was released to the public in January 2021. And now we have the White House Indo-Pacific Strategy that was released in February 2022. But I think if you put them side by side and you look at them, you see that they really have very similar goals and objectives. But I would agree with you that the Biden administration has really filled out the agenda and has really taken it to the next level. We've seen a lot of progress on the Indo-Pacific strategy over the last, I would just say, 6 months even. And yes, this visit to Papua New Guinea by the president is a big deal. It's the first presidential visit to the island, and it follows China's security agreement with the Solomon Islands last year. It follows also the U.S. Pacific Island Summit last fall, the U.S. naming an envoy for the Pacific Islands, Ambassador Yun. So clearly the U.S. is targeting much more of its diplomatic attention to this region. And really, the idea is that we want to prevent the Pacific Islands from becoming strategic assets for China, you know, preventing China from really, you know, allowing these nations to become sort of its sphere of influence, if you will, or even military outposts for China. So this is an important visit. I think this whole idea that Biden's trip will somehow overshadow Modi's is making a mountain out of a molehill. And I think the way we should be thinking about it is their visits reinforce one another. Both the U.S. and India have the same vision for this region, and both are, you know, trying to compete with Chinese influence, let's face it. So I think rather than, you know, talking about upstaging or, you know, who's doing what, that the focus should be on having the same vision and reinforcing each other's messages. It could really be powerful to have, you know, coordinated messaging, sending the same statements, messaging to the region, and the same vision. So I don't see that as a big problem. But in the broader sense, so we have President Biden right after his trip to PNG, going to Australia to Sydney for the third in-person Quad summit in as many years. We see that the Quad is becoming institutionalized. Look, I worked on the Quad when I was at the National Security Council, was involved in the revival of the Quad in 2017. I could have never imagined the progress that has been made on the Quad in just the last 5.5 years. So it really is a critical grouping for shaping the Indo-Pacific, you know, making sure that we're working toward a free, open, liberal order in this region. And I think we can expect, you know, a major package of deliverables. One wonders, you know, there's been so much done. There's so many working groups of the Quad. One wonders, you know, what else can be done? But I think what we'll see is, for instance, more details given on the Indo-Pacific Maritime Domain Awareness Initiative that was announced, of course, a year ago in Tokyo. But I think we'll see that fleshed out. We'll see more details on that. I think we can expect something on the climate change issue, the four countries coming together to deal with this critical issue, as well as something on public health. We know about the work on the vaccines, but there's, of course, more that can be done dealing with public health. So again, the Quad will be showing that it provides public goods to the region, that you have four powerful democracies coming together with capabilities that can actually, you know, bring positive changes and initiatives to the region. Because we know there has been suspicion among the Southeast Asian nations about, you know, is the Quad going to militarize the region, create more tension with China? is it going to displace ASEAN? And of course, there's not a question of displacing ASEAN because ASEAN serves a completely different purpose. ASEAN is about, you know, bringing the countries of the region together around issues, developing consensus. ASEAN is, you know, the central grouping in this region. But what the Quad can do is the Quad can, you know, help shape the region. It can bring the capabilities that are necessary to actually help shape the region. So I think we can expect a successful Quad meeting, further demonstrating its effectiveness and its importance in shaping the region. And it really is coming at a time where there has been tremendous progress between the U.S. and the three nations on a bilateral basis. Well, AUKUS, of course, AUKUS is a trilateral agreement with the U.K., but we just had the major announcement in March of the optimal pathway for providing Australia nuclear-powered submarines. Of course, it's a long time horizon, but it's a very important initiative, sending a very important signal about the U.S. wanting its allies to have the capabilities they need to contribute to deterrence in the Indo-Pacific. And then, of course, with Japan, we've seen some major changes in Japan's defense policies with the release of its national security documents in December, its commitment to increasing its defense budget, getting new defense capabilities, and actually focusing on exporting defense technology to the region, building up its own defense industrial base. This is a major shift for Japan, and it's something the U.S. Very much welcomes. And I think Japan is showing its leadership and that it will contribute to that idea of building a networked security architecture in the region. And then, of course, India, we're getting ready to see Prime Minister Modi visiting Washington in just a few weeks. And we're likely to see more movement on the initiative on critical and emerging technologies, the so-called ISET dialogue, which is an important dialogue between the two countries. We're likely to see more movement on that in terms of technology cooperation, defense cooperation. So I think we really see the Biden administration filling out this Indo-Pacific strategy, working both on a bilateral basis, but also a multilateral basis to really build that kind of networked architecture that isn't, you know, a formal effort. It's not the traditional hub and spoke model with the U.S. at the center. It's more a series of relationships, both bilateral, plurilateral, trilateral, what have you, that are coming together around the same vision. And the vision is one of, you know, maintaining the free and open order in this vital region and maintaining the peace and security and providing deterrence in this critical Indo-Pacific region.
Lisa, thank you. And that that really useful exposition there of U.S. strategy more broadly, I think, prompts a couple of thoughts from me. I think firstly, what a focus on partnership. You know, that there's a lot of myth-making in parts of the commentariat in various places, and also, frankly, coming out of China, that really all the United States is after is to, you know, protect some kind of primacy and push China back into its box, whereas this more comprehensive vision you're talking about is really about partnership with a wide array of regional countries on issues, most of which are not actually hard security issues. Yes, there's a balancing context, but there's, you know, there's a huge amount there in terms of public goods, as you say. There's also that bilateral connection. I think that already bilaterally we're seeing reports that President Biden will be finalising a deal with PNG, or that a deal is being finalised with Papua New Guinea for the United States to support that country in maritime domain awareness bilaterally as well. Which is so vital for a country that has extensive resources, but, you know, pretty finite security capabilities of its own. And then the connection with Australia in all of this you know, you say that you're surprised that the Quad has flourished quite so much as it has. And what we're seeing now here is very, very clear bipartisanship in this country. We have a Labor government a year in office. In fact, the Quad will be exactly a year to the day. The Quad summit will be a year to the day since the last Quad summit, I think, in Tokyo, which was immediately after the Australian election. Where we had a change of government to a party that once upon a time didn't seem to be all that enamoured of the Quad, and now there's the strong bipartisanship ownership of it. And, of course, the three visiting Quad leaders in Australia will be, to the extent possible, I think, having their own bilateral programs as well. And I won't quite foreshadow what those will be yet, but I think we'll be seeing quite a bit of the three leaders outside of the Quad meeting. So lots of resonances there. Can I turn now to the summit in more detail? And I might actually go back to Noble, back to Professor Kanehara, for your expectations of what you think Japan and Prime Minister Kishida is wanting out of this Quad summit in Sydney.
Well, he is going to meet many important messages. One is we have to support Ukraine in unity as the West. Two, we have to face the rise of China. Two things mainly. One is the independence, the mutual independence in the free markets is precious. And nobody should weaponize this. And if it is done, the West must unite in unity. And we have to get attention. Japan in particular wants to get attention of the Westerners over the issue of Taiwan. This is the West Berlin in the Pacific. If we lose that, we lose the credibility. And then third is, of course, nuclear weapons. Kishida-san is from Hiroshima, and he heard many stories from the parents of his own city completely destroyed. But he is also worried about the surrounding nations expanding their nuclear arsenal. And I think he's going to warn that the situation in Asia about nuclear race. And these things are, of course, beyond that, we have to take over the traditional agenda, like the gender, global climate, and the economic resilience of the supply chains. We're going to talk about that, of course. But for him, the main issue is unity of the West, enhancing the liberal order into global South, engagement of that, in particular India, and then China and the India and other issues. Sorry.
Do you see, Norbert? Do you see those as agenda items for G7 or Quad or both?
Oh, both.
Yeah.
The G7 is the leader of the West, right? We engage their Europeans. This is very important. This is heavily Eurocentric organization, so we have to engage Europeans. But here, in the Pacific, our allies are quite limited. There's no NATO here. The very strong allies of US is Japan and Australia. And Yoon Suk-yeol is very helpful, but Korea always flips-flops. When the left-wingers takes power, they go astray. Now we have to engage Koreans very well. And now we have to, in this region, we have to pay attention to the Pacific Islands. We can never let this region vacuum for absorbing Chinese influence. And this is a vast area and strategically very important, in particular for naval, aerial, military operations. These islands are very important. And it is a good chance to draw attention of the world, the Westerners, the Europeans, pay attention to this region. Because the French is there. We have to engage them here too.
So there's some interesting points there and probably slightly provocative points as well in some of those thoughts, Noble, because, of course, some voices, when they hear the words the West and India in the same sentence, would suggest that's not necessarily compatible. I'm someone who, for example, has spoken about deeper engagement with India as a partner in the democratic world, but I would hesitate to call India a Western country. Darshana, I'm going to go back to you about Indian expectations for the Quad, because there are some obvious tensions here, one of which is, of course, India's position, the Indian government position on the Ukraine conflict and on Russia's invasion of Ukraine and on the way to address this problem. You know, there is clearly a mismatch between the Indian position and the position of the other three Quad countries. And some voices say, well, that points to, a fatal flaw in the Quad. How do you see Indian expectations of the Quad summit? And I guess how would you address this question of compatibility of national visions or otherwise, and does it matter?
I'll take the tough question first on the compatibility issue and sort of, the Russia-Ukraine thing, because I think that is something that we should talk about and should be addressed, and it came up pretty strong. In fact, I was in DC when I've been in DC the whole when the war in Ukraine broke out, and I saw the sentiment on the ground move on India, like start doubting in terms of even people who have been absolute fierce proponent of advancing the relationship in India, some were stopped and paused and did ask the question, are we on the right track here? If the four countries don't even agree on what constitutes an aggression, how, at what level is the compatibility? And I think these are right questions to be asked, and these are natural questions to be asked. But then it also shows in terms of the different in terms of the relationship, right? Whether not just within the Quad, but I think it's just India's relationship in much of the world that will be shaped with through sort of conversations and on the platform that India engages, because sitting outside of the wheel of treaty alliances, sitting outside of sort of, the whole West, North, South kind of division and all of it, yet has very similar converging interests and concerns and challenges with the others. But I think it is important to accept, and I don't think so, accepting the fact that India's view of the world at times would be different because of its own history is significantly different than the other three in the grouping, speaks to an incompatibility issue. I think it just talks toward the complexities of the 21st century, that the answers to a lot of problems are not going to be as simple and straightforward as or as incoherent as we have seen in the past, because of number of issues, whether change in multilateral formats, the way countries engage, United Nations forms and reforms and all of that, right? Like, and I think history has a lot to play on that. India's own narrative, stance, and conversation on Ukraine has evolved significantly from that first statement at the UN. I think India has made changes in its language that is clear in saying that, this war has to stop and, it's in no one's good and needs to come down. Where India has not been as direct as calling Russia out in its aggression as the other three have been. So again, it is the approach where there is no disagreement that this is, this aggression and this is a war, because I remember when Prime Minister Modi, I can't remember when he finally said that this war has to stop, was basically acknowledging that this is a war without calling, I guess Russia out. On the compatibility question, I think if Russia Ukraine is one of the indications of maybe there are differences between the Quad, there are others as well, right? One is geography. In terms of that, each of the four countries look at different aspects of the Indo-Pacific as its priority area of importance. If India looks at the entire Indian Ocean as its area, its geography, its primary area, the other three don't look at it in the same way, or India doesn't look at the Pacific in the same way of priority the way US would and Australia would, or the way Japan does for Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia, right? But is that cause for incompatibility? I don't think so. I think these are all sovereign choices and the complexities that come with working with sovereign nations who, despite having really close and strong partnerships, will have differences and will have different set of choices and will have different set of approach, because it's shaped by your security environment. It's also shaped by your domestic conversation. So I don't necessarily see that as an issue. I think I have great hope, and I think there is a lot of trust at the bilateral level between each of the four countries involved. It has only continued to improve, and I have great trust in the communication between the four nations that exist. I have, in different aspects and different issues I've seen at the bilateral, at the trilateral, even at the quadrilateral level, managing difference of opinions far better than I think we could have ever imagined in the 5 years ago, forget 10 years ago, right? So I think that trust and communication today exists mostly at the bilateral level, that has translated to the quadrilateral level, that it will allow and it will still give space for Quad to continue working on areas where it sees eye to eye and where there's a convergence. And I would say convergence are still outweigh the challenges and the divergences or difference of opinion among the Quad. And I think that is still the stronghold and probably at the core of the Quad partners in a number of issues.
And on what those areas are, would you tend to agree with some of the other assessments we've heard today about, for example, public goods, digital connectivity, maritime domain awareness, that kind of thing? Is that where you see, Dashana, the agenda likely to go in Sydney?
Yes, absolutely. I think the fact sheet, the sort of the roadmap that came up out of the summit in Washington that was put out, that had created a roadmap in terms of, and the working groups came out of it, I think that would still serve as the basis or the framework or the skeleton of what Quad would build on. Say with the under maritime or under tech, there might be different aspects or different specific issues that might come up, but I think that's still the broader agenda, because there's so much that is already on the agenda. I don't see something significantly new topic being come into it, maybe new aspects of the decided topic that would come into it, but there's a lot already on the plate that the Quad can do and can deliver. IPMDA has already been a great initiative. I mean, both Lisa and I are in the region, and I think I've definitely heard conversations about it. I think it's a good thing that Quad works towards the public delivery of, in terms of greater goods and working towards the region, because you really aren't a useful coalition if the region doesn't think you're useful. So I think that is a good metric to have, that, you know, it should come up with an initiative that's important to the region. On the military side of it, I think there is an aspect to it. Of course, there are very strong bilateral military relationship between all of them. Actually, India, Australia has really good relationship. I think it's only growing. India, Japan has India, US has, and of course, Japan, Australia, Japan, US, Australia, US as well. So there'll always be that element, and there will somewhere these bilateral and trilateral will feed into the quadrilateral. And I think it's not that it's not on the radar. I don't think so. It's not that it's not on the horizon. And if there are issues that come up, I do think Quad would probably be in the space to respond to something should there be political appetite. But it's not the front and center of it. It's not the driving factor of it. It is happening more at the bilateral level, with the option to turn it into quadrilateral through, say, Malabar, where the platforms exist. And I do think that's the right approach to take, but it's the larger agenda, I think, would be on sort of more on non-traditional or, say, non-military. I because, you know, there's this whole conversation about, is climate really a non-traditional security issue when it creates so many other issues? I'll say non-military.
Look, thanks, Dashana. We're going to wrap up in a moment, but Lisa, I might just give you the last word, because although there will obviously be bilateral visits by the three leaders to Australia in conjunction with the Quad summit, I think there may be some particular anticipation about President Biden's visit. Do you have a sense of what you think his key messages to Australia will be, or should be, or both?
Well, I think that there will be an emphasis on AUKUS and how important that is for the bilateral relationship. I think there will be, a conveyance of the importance of the U.S.-Australian relationship in carrying out the Indo-Pacific strategy and a real appreciation for everything that Australia is doing on that front. And the Quad will also obviously be a very central focus of that overall visit. I guess it just focusing a little bit on what the previous speakers had said, of course, Professor Kamihari talked about the importance of the Ukraine issue and Japan building its ties with Europe. Of course, NATO is reportedly opening a liaison office in Tokyo, perhaps next year, which would be a big deal, the first time it's opened a liaison office in Asia. So we see that, again, Japan is taking a strong role in connecting or linking what's happening in Europe and what's happening in the Indo-Pacific. This is in contrast to what we see from India. And I think, this is a difficult issue because I think the other Quad members completely understand India's position. But at the same time, there are negative things that are coming out of that position or disadvantages that we have to acknowledge. We have to be honest with ourselves about the fact that, India's position of neutrality doesn't set a good example for other nations, other Indo-Pacific nations, and kind of the position they're taking. It also gives China cover for its own neutrality toward the war.
I suspect neutrality is a polite way of describing it, but go ahead.
Yeah, and I think in the long run, the position of not supporting territorial sovereignty of Ukraine weakens the idea of the importance of maintaining territorial sovereignty in the Indo-Pacific. And so I think those are some of the disadvantages of India's position. But that's not to say that the other Quad members don't completely understand that India is in a very difficult position. It really has no good choices. And they're willing to set aside the differences over Russia in order to focus on the very important agenda for the overall Indo-Pacific. So it is a difficult matter to manage, but I think so far, they're doing a pretty good job of keeping the Quad focused on the Indo-Pacific and, setting aside India's differences over the Russia issue.
Thank you. We're going to have to leave it there. This is one of those conversations where there's just so much ground to cover. I'm really glad that you've managed to cover so much of the key terrain in a relatively brief time. And it really is going to be an exceptional season of diplomacy in the Indo-Pacific, everything from the G7 right through, as we say, to the Modi-Biden summit in the second half of June with PNG, the Quad, Shangri-La, so much in between. So, look, thank you again, Lisa Curtis, Nobukatsu Kanahara and Ashana Barua for joining the Quad Pod at the National Security College on the National Security Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.